community is the backbone of continuity. Okay. I'm going to do a combination of just talking and using my crib sheet, like most lecturers do. Okay. The Jewish community life of the diaspora centered on the synagogue and its related functions. Sounds real boring, but it really is fascinating. Because I take for granted you all have a nice Jewish history education, right? So I can assume certain things. All right, I'll assume certain things. In other words, how does Jewish community start in terms of the kinds of things that we're talking about? And by the way, I'm focusing, of course, on the Jews as the Middle East. It goes all the way back to the challenge that was faced, major challenge that was faced by the Jewish people after the destruction of the first temple. In the ancient world, what happened was that religion was connected to two major things. One of them was a central temple. The Jews were one of the people that had the central temple. And it was also connected with a geographic locus. You had to be connected with the land in which your religion started. Jews were forcibly transferred, as we all know, from Eretz Israel to Babel. And that first couple of generations had to face this issue of, can we continue, A, without the temple, and B, without the land? And the answer, of course, as we know, is that they managed to recreate themselves within Babel. And one of the tools to survival was the creation of the Beit HaKnesset, the synagogue. Now, over the 1,000 years or so, before we get to the kinds of stuff I'm going to talk about tonight, as a preliminary to what I'm going to do in terms of modernity, the Jews came back to Eretz Israel and they brought the synagogue with them. Okay? In other words, what happens during the Second Temple period is that you have the recreation of the Beit HaMikdash, the second one, but the Beit Knesset does not disappear. It is not left behind in Babel. And it becomes very much part of what the Jews are doing inside Eretz Israel, as well as what they're doing in Babel. And this forms the, in part, the experience of diaspora that enables the Jews to survive as Jews with the destruction of the Second Temple. And then you get the major dispersion over all of the Middle East, all of North Africa, and then, of course, up into Europe and what becomes Ashkenaz. What does the Beit Knesset do? Well, it's not just the Beit Knesset, and we all know this. We talk about the needs of the community. Jews cannot live just as an individual family in the middle of nowhere. We have enough experience with American Jewish history to show what happened when, let's say, the Jews came over here and they moved. One family would move up into New England, a small town in New England, open a grocery store, no schools, no anything. You have major problems with the next generation. Okay? Unless there's going to be a choice that you're going to be sending your children to a larger community. So I'm kind of jumping the gun, but what we have over here is the Beit Knesset as a place of assembly for prayer. You need minyan to read the Torah. This is part of what developed over the millennia. It's a place of study. Okay, so the Beit Knesset is gathering not just for prayer, but it's also for study of Torah. It also becomes a place for educating the younger generation, because without the kind of education you're going to have, you're not going to be able to transmit everything orally. There has to be, and the Jews discovered this very early on, it has to be, people have to be literate. Okay, but it also goes beyond that. In terms of, I'm talking about the Beit Knesset and what becomes the Jewish community, becomes more than that, because within diaspora communities, there are all kinds of needs that the Jews have. Kashrut. Okay, you're going to need somebody who's going to be the shochet. You're going to have somebody who's going to have to supervise that the shochet is doing what they're supposed to do. And you have to have all of this stuff available within walking distance so that people can go and buy meat. Which meat people ate. It's usually connected with Shabbat. We're not going over there. It's much easier if you're going to be raising fowl. You know, fowl, anybody could do the shvitah of fowl. Think about going to the chicken and watching it run by. I remember as a kid, up in the mountains, because we lived up in Canada when I was a child, and summertime we were up in the Laurentians, and there's no shochet up there, and I remember my father doing the chicken. And that was not a fun thing. It's good nightmares where you become vegetarian for a good long while, right? You know, this kind of stuff. But if it's going to be meat, you know, four-legged meat, then you need, as you well know, you need a shochet. So that becomes part of the function of the community. More important than the Bet Knesset, as you should all know, is that every community that starts has to have a mikvah. Because without Taharat HaMishpacha, which is one of the basic elements of Jewish life, you're not going to have the continuity either. So the mikvah takes priority over the building of the Bet Knesset, because you can meet anywhere and have a Bet Knesset, a room in somebody's house. Mikvah is a little more difficult to go about setting up. And with the exception of just one or two communities of the Middle East that I can think of, the majority of the mikvahot that date all the way back in time are actually buildings, they're construction. It's not the women going to the river, which is what they did, for example, in Kurdistan, or they did in parts certain parts of Yemen. Okay, Middle Eastern Jews actually built the mikvahot, similar to the kinds of things that you have with the building of Hamas. I don't have to define these terms in this community, right? My others, I do. But what else? It turns out that the, I'm sorry, my nose runs with a combination of the cold and my wonderful allergies. Hold on to this. Oh, there. All right. What else does the community provide all the way back, as far as we can see, the period of the Second Temple and in the diaspora communities? Is that you gradually have other kinds of functions that the Jewish community plays as well, centered on the synagogue. Talking about Middle Eastern construction, okay? Construction is around the courtyard, okay? So you have the synagogue very often, let's take the Egyptian setup, which is the easiest one for me to deal with, because yeah, that's already relatively late, we're talking about 9th century, Cairo. You have a square with a courtyard inside. The Knesset is only part of the square. You go into the gateway, entrance into the Bet Knesset this way, but you have a compound that has a lot of different buildings in it. And the Bet Knesset does not necessarily, the community does not necessarily own all of the buildings over there. So you sometimes get Muslims living in the courtyard with the Jewish communities, which leads to all kinds of interesting things that we see reflected in court cases. One of the things, so you have the mikvah as part of it there, which would be alongside the Bet Knesset, and you have an inn, a hostelry. Jews traveled, merchants traveled, caravans came, right? Where do people stay? Depends on the size of the community. Not everybody had enough room to house all of the people that were coming in, not everybody wanted to stay in people's homes. So the community itself was able to provide a kind of early form of the Hilton. And they charged a certain amount of fees, and the fees went towards the community chest, which I'll come to in a second. What I find even more interesting than that, and we find it reflective, the Jews, I don't know who started it, but it certainly is part of the acculturation of what you find in the larger Muslim community as well as within the Jewish community, is that you have local kind of hospitals, early types of hospitals, people who were very sick, or people who were poor, and couldn't afford the kind of care that you needed couldn't afford in your house. The community also provided a kind of hospital with visits on the part of the doctors fairly often, twice a week. If it was insanity, it would have been a little, you know, once every month that they would come and check up on it. Did this exist? The answer is yes, it did. It depends, of course, which community we're talking about. And of course, one of the provisions, one of the things that Jews needed as part of the community was courts. They needed what they did. They were very contentious people. So these court cases go all the way back in time as far as we can tell. So there were courts, and the community also handled tzedakah. Yes, you gave personal private tzedakah, but the larger things that we have material that can show that the communities were organized around was the handing out, the collection of tzedakah and the distribution of it. Okay, so this is before the rise of Islam. All of this existed more or less before the rise of Islam, and it's pretty much true all the way across the Jewish world, wherever you had sizable diaspora communities. When Islam began, and you had the invasion from Arabia, we're talking about the 7th century now, and I gave you your map so that you can see where Arabia is, and how the... Oh, that's great. Okay, I have one right here. Okay, so you can see where it's called Saudi Arabia on this map because this is modern political boundaries. This is not what the world looked like at the time of Muhammad. So it starts in Arabia. The armies march north towards what on this map says Jordan and Syria and Israel, and then eastward through Iraq, through Iran, and up to the borders of Afghanistan. Didn't really get to Turkey during the earlier period. At the same time that you had the armies marching in that direction, they moved westward across Egypt, along the coastal area in particular, Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. By the time they get to about the 700s, they're already crossing over into Spain. I don't have Spain included in the Middle East over here because this, as I said, is a modern map, and Spain is now part of Europe. Okay, so at the time of the 7th century Muslim conquest, the Jews of the Middle East and North Africa had already experienced centuries of autonomous living in small communities, and thus their adjustment to the newly imposed status that the Muslims imposed upon them, okay, was not difficult. What kind of status is this? The Arabic word is zimmi. Okay, zimmi. Zimmi, protective. Minority group, protective. Religions that had holy scriptures, because by the time Muhammad died, Islam had morphed enough in the direction of accepting the Gospels and the Jewish Bible as holy texts with errors, human errors, not divine errors. That's why Islam came with the Quran, which is the perfect book. That's a different topic. Okay, so what do we do as the Muslims had to decide with all of these huge numbers, not of Jews, but of Christians, as they were about to cross over into the central part of the Middle East, because Byzantium was ruling over there, they came up with the idea of treating the Jews as dhimmi, okay, as protected people. And we have contracts, literally contracts, that were signed between the various communities. Within we have the most famous ones are the ones of Damascus. I, the Bishop of Damascus, hereby make this contract with the conquering general of the Arab armies. We will be protected in terms of practicing our religion, being able to own property, and having protection of our personal rights. And in return for that, we take second-class status. And the Jews already had experience of being second-class citizens. And they weren't that unhappy to have the Muslims come, because under the Byzantines, life was pretty crappy. Pretty rotten. All right, I'm not supposed to use words like that. And under the Persian Empire, things were even worse at this time. So again, you had the Jews not unhappy that the Muslims were coming along. And as long as the Jewish communities paid their two forms of taxes, the Arab governments did not care what the Jews did. The two taxes, we have the poll tax, the head tax, P-O-L-L, poll tax, which is paid by all men of army age. Okay, so that would be from about the age of 13, depending on which community, 17, 16, up to about the age of 50, which is what would be within the Arab army. Second-class citizens did not serve in the army, so you're paying a tax instead. Women did not pay. Everybody paid, rich and poor. If you could not pay, and by the way, it was graded like an income tax. So the richer you were, the more you paid, but there was an upward limit. And the poorer you were, the less you paid, but there was a lower limit as well. Couldn't pay, the community was responsible. So the Muslims were very smart. They said, okay, they've got this community structure. We're going to work through the community structure and make sure that our taxes are paid. The second tax that was paid was a land tax called Haraj in Arabic. And there are scholars that say that one of the reasons why Middle Eastern Jews, with two and a half exceptions, became city people is because the burden of the Haraj was so heavy that they couldn't pay for the agricultural land, and gradually within 100 years, about the same period of time that Arabic took over as the language, you have the Jews showing up almost completely in the cities. Okay? And they become city people. Small cities, big cities, medium-sized cities, and the communications that Jews kept between themselves and among themselves. Okay, so what happens, therefore, is that everybody in the Middle East is defined by their religious identity. Nobody did not belong. That was incorrect English, but you know what I mean. Everybody had to belong to a religious community. That's how you were defined. And therefore, it was the people in charge of personal status of the Jews that became important people, people of power. We use the term rabbi. It's easier to use that term than to get into all the specifics that the different communities had. So the rabbis dominated Jewish life. They were the ones who made the legal decisions, and they were the ones who were the recognized heads of the synagogue. And the synagogue ended up being, as I said, the most important center. Which rabbis, or who were the rabbis? Well, we know enough in terms of Jewish history to know that you had dynasties of rabbis, very famous families. But if you were talented, just as in the Islamic world, if you were talented, you were an individual, didn't come from an illustrious family, but you shone because of your own intellectual power. And by the way, the school system of the Jews was geared, just as you had among the Muslims, was geared towards finding these talented young men, boys, as they started out, and then moving up the ranks. You could also make it into a position of rabbinic power, and you were married off into the rich families. You were grabbed up right away, which is the second sentence of power in the Jewish community. Rabbinic power versus, sometimes versus in a very strong form, lay leadership. Who are the lay leaders? These are usually the wealthy men. I'll deal with women's world in the next one, because you have women who play pretty strong roles in some of these places as well. Okay, so right from the start, you have the tensions between these two centers. You have the rabbinic power and you have the lay power. Money, yichus. You have this kind of thing going back and forth. Often, depending on which community, certainly back then, when you had the setting up of the yeshivot that were there with the very wealthy Jews along with there, they worked in tandem and they were very politically oriented. So who became an important rabbi, who got which in which synagogue, or who rose to the highest levels of which yeshiva was just as political as what we have nowadays. So life doesn't really change very much. How do you enforce decisions? That's an interesting thing. Now, remember that people lived within the Jewish community. You had to be part of the Jewish community. You didn't like what was going on. You could move to a different city or a different town or a different country or a different part of the empire, but you're going to end up within a Jewish community anyway, because there was no such thing as living in isolation. The only out, if you were really upset with what was going on, was conversion. And that was a major, major decision. Therefore, let's take it on the other side. How did the Beit Din, which didn't have the power of the army and didn't have the power of the police, get its decisions carried through? It had the internal control of, you don't do what we say, you don't get an Aliyah La Torah, you don't get Pticha, you have difficulty getting a Moel for your son, if your son needs a Brit Milah. You know, all of these types of community powers, which belonged to a religious community, could be used and were used. Okay, so everybody towed the line. Everybody towed the line. Whenever we have an example of an exception to this kind of thing, for example, I'm thinking of Geniza document that I just read through, where you have, don't forget that slaves are very much part of the community, where you have a woman slave who the male head of this particular outstanding Jewish family was having an affair with the slave in his household, which was so unusual. It almost never happened that the community was going to put a ban on him. He found out about it beforehand, and he ran away from Egypt to Eretz Israel, thinking he would be able to escape from what was going on over there. They came after him, and they forced him to give a get to the primary wife, to the main wife that he had in Cairo. So unless you're going to end up all the way in Spain, you were the long reach of the community was there. And by the way, I should mention this, that you have local power, you have regional power, and you have the power within the empire. So as long as the Arab control was located, for example, in Iraq and Baghdad, okay, then, and the empire was the Abbasid Empire, which lasted until 1258, before Baghdad was destroyed, which according to the news tonight, looks as if we're going to have something interesting happening again. All right, I mean, they had this thing on Channel 2 News about Saddam Hussein walking. He said, oh, I won the war. You know, they had this whole analysis. He thinks he won the Gulf War. You know, it's amazing.
They put a whole museum on showing his victories there.
Yeah, I mean, and it's just incredible. But then you have to see this in the context of his insanity. But I got distracted. Okay, let me get back to this. So what we have, therefore, is kind of different centers of power. You have local center, provincial center, and then empire centers of power. And people kept in touch with each other. Because what you had during this period of time was what Professor Goitein called Pax Islamica. So you had such a strong control of all of the travel routes, all of the land routes, as well as all of the sea routes, people could travel everywhere. Okay? They could bring their goods. They could be merchants and go all over the world. You could go all the way to China. You could go up to Ashkenaz. You could go down to India. You could go down to Africa. And everything was protected by the government. And the Jews flourished in a situation like that. Okay. I'm leaving out a lot of stuff, so if some of you have questions afterwards, you can ask me. Now, what happens with the fall of the Abbasids? And by the way, even at the time that the Abbasids were ruling with the capital in Iraq, in Baghdad, you already had rival centers of power, both Muslims and Jewish, because Jewish centers of power usually followed where you had Muslim new dynasties within the world of Islam. So Spain, for example, becomes a very important center of Jewish life, rivaling Baghdad. We have correspondence between the two countries. And Egypt separates as well because it comes under a different dynasty called Fatimids. They were actually Shi'i, which is incredible to think considering what the Shi'is do in Iran, which I'll get to a little bit later on if I have time. Okay, so it's not unified. You have Jews living all over. You have rivals, but rivals heads. You have rival rabbinic dynasties. You have rival communities. And as I said before, the generalization that we can make is that you have within the communities, generally it's rabbinic versus lay leadership. Now what happens when the Turks conquer? I'm skipping a couple of hundred years. The Mongols come and invade in 1258. There's an interregnum of about 200, 300 years. And the Turks come moving in. They come from all the way out in the Far East. They come across. It's very interesting. I deal with this in Cor 9, as some of you have taken. Of course, you don't remember anything that I taught at that time, but I'm not looking at anybody in particular. They all remember my stories. They don't remember the material that I covered. But, yeah, one or two things. So the Turks take over, the Ottoman Turks, and after they take over Turkey, central Turkey, Anatolia, and move off into the Balkans and create what ends up becoming the mess in Yugoslavia or ex-Yugoslavia, which is now falling apart again, and Romania and Hungary all the way up through there, they conquer their fellow Muslims, namely the Arabs. So they move southward about 1517, 1518, and they take over almost the entire Arabic-speaking Middle East, keeping control more or less on the level the farther away you are. You just pay your taxes. There's a governor that's sent out there, and it's pretty much only Morocco that escapes. Okay, by this time, Spain has been reconquered, as they called it, by the Christians. And what, in terms of the Jewish communities, the Ottoman Turks follow good Islamic tradition. They just don't call the Jews Zimmi, or the Christians Zimmi. They call them by a different term, called a millet, M-I-L-L-E-T. They call it a millet. They're millet groups, internal autonomy, and everything continues pretty much the same way it had for all of these hundreds and hundreds of years that I'm talking about, until we get to the 19th century. 19th century, things change. Okay, and the book that I'm speaking from, in other words, what my colleagues and I put together in the book, is the focus on the modern period. Because most people, most scholars deal with the earlier part until the 19th century, and then things become so complex that nobody wanted to touch that, except you find one special book here, one special book there, but not as an overview of the entire Middle East and the Balkans. What happens in the 19th century, focusing on community, is that you have two types of changes that begin to take place. One of them can be defined as internal to the Middle East. The second one comes from the outside, it's external to the Middle East. The internal, I forgot to keep track of how much time I'm talking, okay. Internal to the Middle East, we're talking about two types of things. One of them is from the Ottoman Turks themselves, and the second type of change comes about as a result of the conquest or the colonization by Western powers. Okay, so let me first deal with the changes that come about as a result of the Turks themselves. In the 19th century, as a result of some very complex things, you begin to get Western pressure on the Turkish Empire to try to modernize. Taxes aren't being collected as well as they should be collected. We advise you, this is what the Westerners said to the Turks, that in order to get loans from us, this is what they said to the Sultan, we will agree to these loans on condition that you begin to bring in changes. It also has to do, the internal changes, with the fact that Napoleon invaded Egypt and defeated a Turkish army so badly that the Middle East kind of stood still in shock, because this was the first time that it came home to them that they had been passed by in terms of there was no industrialization, no industrial revolution, and the fact that the Westerners had these weapons, these incredible weapons, and a whole different type of army organization brought home with a great big shock to the Middle Easterners, especially to the Sultans of Turkey, that something had happened. We want these weapons. We want this knowledge. How do we get this knowledge? Okay, now, when you get this knowledge and you begin to negotiate with, let's say, the French or the British, we'd like to send our young men to study in your military schools, these young men don't only come home with all these ideas of the military stuff, they also come home with the ideas of the French Revolution. They come home with these new ideas about what industrialization is. They talk about democracy, talk about these types of things. So for about 100 years, you have the Turks themselves involved in what they themselves call the Tanzimat, the reorganization. How does this affect the Jews? It affected the Jews because they tried to impose on the Jewish communities a reorganization. And they did this starting with the rabbinic level. They created a Chacham Bashi, a chief rabbi, and this creation of a chief rabbi was in order that he should be able to speak for all of the Jews of the entire Ottoman Empire, and he became an appointee, to a certain extent, of the state, which the Jewish community didn't like, you know, because they felt after a while that this one was just a puppet of the Sultan, and that one was a puppet of the Sultan. So you get internal politics coming into view as well. But it was even more than that. You get the reorganization of the lay organizations as well. So they wanted the Jews to set up a 120-man general council that would be elected by the local community, and of course they would all be represented by a smaller group. I'm not going to get into the details of that. Everything centered in Istanbul, because that was the capital of the empire. So Syria, which was divided into a couple of different provinces, would have to elect representatives of this lay group and send them to, in the middle of the 19th century, and send them to participate in this type of council, this type of general council to decide on issues that had to do with the Jews. What you really had over here was an attempt on the part of the Sultan to really gain very tight control over the minority groups, right? And be able to make sure that they were paying all of the fees that they wanted them to pay. Did it work in terms of inside the Jewish community? Not really. It just kind of added on another bit of tension that wasn't there before. But what I'd like to do is just move now into the issue of colonialism and colonialization of the Middle East, and just very briefly mention which ones were very much affected by the colonial powers and which countries were not. So if you look at your map, let's start with Morocco, because that's the easiest one to deal with. The North African ones are easier to deal with. Okay? North Africa comes under French control, except for a small part in the north which comes under Spanish control. Spaniards control so little that most, you know, I'm not really going to deal with anything in this lecture. It's mainly the French control that you have. What the French tried to do with the Jewish community is, on a mini level, the creation of a kind of chief rabbi as well. And they wanted to do this, again, because they wanted to be able to reach the Jews more easily. It's easier if you talk to one man, and then he contacts all of the other rabbis, and that's the direction that you have the French taking over there. So you get to the 20th century, where things are different. Let's skip over Algeria and get to Tunisia. By the way, I should say that even though I'm making generalizations, each Jewish community in each of the different countries that I'm talking about has its own coloration. Okay? So what happens in Morocco has a very strong Sephardic in the true sense of the word, of having come from Spain with all of the names and the language and everything else, living in the northern part of Morocco. And the further south that you go, the more Arabized the group is, the more local or native they tend to call it. I hate that term. Okay. Tunisia has a different coloration. They have indigenous Jews who are called, the Arabic word is the Tuansa, and then they have immigrant Jews that come from Italy, from the city of Livorno. And they keep Italian citizenship, isn't quite the term one should use, but it's easier for us to use that term over here. They're called the Grana, and they stayed in two entirely separate communities down to today. Okay? You meet anybody from Tunisia, they'll immediately tell you whether they are from which group and the pride that goes along with each one. The one that came from Italy are Sephardim. They originally came from Spain. They came from Spain to Italy. Livorno is a totally Sephardic city. You have almost no Italian Jews living there. You have to take my course in the Jews of Italy to know how that happened. And then you had families that sent representatives down there. Usually they're merchant families that came and settled in Tunisia. So that when the French took over in the late 19th century and they set up a French protectorate over there, they recognized the two separate communities, but they tried their darndest to get the two to at least talk to each other and to cooperate with the French authorities. So officially they were all cooperating. In fact, everybody was doing their own separate things in terms of community control. That's what happens in Tunisia. Libya comes under Italian control. It's invaded by Italy in 1911, and it remains under Italian control until the defeat of the Axis during World War II. So that the Libyan Jews who live in the main in the north, and they live mainly in the big towns, become very Italianized, and they speak Italian. And I work with the new group that left in 1967 and ended up in Italy. They live mainly in Rome. There's about 5,000 or so Libyan Jews that live there. Very strong, strongly connected as a community. But I'm going to save that until I get to the end of what I have to say, because, you know, how do you define community today? So Italy organized its Jews in Libya the same way its Jews in Italy are organized. So you have Western type of organization coming in that way. The Jews of Egypt are very heterogeneous. Now, they come from all over the Middle East, and you have Ashkenazi Jews that have come in there as well. Similar to what happened in Istanbul, everybody organized their own synagogue. Okay? Yeah. My Nusach is my Nusach. My Trop is my Trop. My Minhagim are my Minhagim. And for a long time, you really do not have intercommunal marriages. And you can trace the Egyptian Jews to each of the different groups that are there. What happens, however, is that when the English come in, when the British come in 1882, they tried to get some kind of umbrella organization, and you have, therefore, as a result of British action, you get both rabbinic unified decision-making as well as lay leadership. Algeria, which I skipped over, in case you noticed it, okay, Algeria becomes southern France. This becomes, in 1839, when the French invade, this is the only Middle Eastern country that is invaded and doesn't even become a colony. It becomes southern France, in the sense that the French people do not just come in terms of governors, they come to settle. The farmers come. They take over some of the best lands, some of the not so great lands. That's why the war for independence that takes place in Algeria is a civil war. Whereas all the others are not civil wars. They're just getting the French out. This is not just getting the French out. This is citizens fighting citizens. Okay? And what happens in terms of the Jewish community in Algeria is that they're organized exactly the way they are in France, okay, according to the communauté that they have over there. So that the experience that they have over there is very, very different than the rest of the consistoire system. Is very different from what happens in the rest of the Middle East. Okay, I'm not going to get into all of that, except that I should mention that as part of the consistoire system, the rabbis become civil servants. They're paid by the state, like the Chacham Bashi is paid by the state. Okay. That's a very important change that takes place. Okay, so if Algeria becomes the most modern and Western of all of the Jewish communities in the region, the three communities that remain the most traditional are Yemen, Iran, and Afghanistan. most traditional. Yemen, exactly the way I described it before, they have the rabbis, who they call the morid, because they remain the spiritual leaders. They have a rabbinical council, or a bet din, and they make all the decisions for the community. Iran, they just have a different name. They call their rabbi a mullah. They call their bet din, or their whole organization, the chavra. And the only change that you get in the 20th century is that the chavra changes to a Persian word, and they come to be called the anjuman. Okay, but they're very, very traditional all the way down into the mid-20th century, or until they leave the country. Now, what happens to Palestine, Ottoman Palestine, as it's called? Here, what happens in the 19th, and certainly at the end of the 19th century, is that you have divisions not only based on ethnic, cultural, and linguistic origins, but you get the Halutzim coming in. You get political Zionism coming in. So that's going to add another element of secularism into what goes on over there. The British take over at the end of World War I. They try to make Palestine into a Western society. It doesn't work because the Arabs are not going to cooperate with them. They end up treating the Jewish communities inside Palestine, inside Eretz Israel, as millets. So that what happens in terms of the Zionists realize what's happening, these are politically organized, these are the Ashkenazim that are coming from Eastern Europe on Aliyah, first Aliyah, second Aliyah, third Aliyah, they set up a quasi-government within the structure of this millet system. And they teach themselves how to be democratic and how to have the kinds of institutions that eventually become the basis of Medinat Yisrael, of the free Israel. The British do the same thing in Iraq. They do the same thing because they have a mandate there. And the French do what I described in North Africa to Syria and Lebanon, because those become French mandates. Okay, let me skim through the rest of this. So what happens in terms of modernization is that internal to the Middle East, you get Zionism, you get a kind of generation gap, you get politics, and you get the fight over education. The fight over education comes from outside. This is the second element of the 19th century. External to the Middle East, the most important thing that arrives to change the Jewish community structure coming from the West is the Alliance Israelite Universelle. Comes into existence in part as a reaction to the Damascus blood libel, okay? And it's organized in Paris, okay? But not just by French Jews, it's also by British Jews originally, but then it's taken over by the French. And the idea behind this is to protect Jewish rights in the Middle East, okay? So that's one of their most important roles that they play at the beginning. But what they also end up doing is we have to help our benighted brethren in the Middle East and bring them into modernity through modern schools. And this is where the lines are drawn in terms of community war. Yes, they're bringing in modern education. That's wonderful. What don't they teach? They don't teach Torah. Okay? What don't they teach? They don't teach in the language of the local community. They're bringing in French because they represent France. These are French Jews where the tricolor very, very proudly, and yes, it's important what they did. They came with the same attitude to Middle Eastern Jews as the French brought in as the colonial power. We are the Westerners, we know what's best, we're the ones who can make decisions, and this is what you're going to do. Now, the schools that are set up play an incredibly important role in terms of the modernization of the Jewish communities of the Middle East. The rabbis fought in every single country and in every single city in order to change curriculum, have at least some kind of set up where they would go to the Alliance during the morning and then they would come to their regular Hebrew school in the afternoon where they would learn Torah. Some communities they won out. The only community that was strong enough to keep the Alliance out was Aleppo. Okay? That's what brought it. The only one they managed to keep it out. But I can't knock the Alliance completely because what they did in Iran, for example, was incredibly important because Iran had its own particular historical experience of major, major decline in terms of level of education and Jewish knowledge. And with the arrival of the Alliance at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century, Jewish education, which they realized they had to do as well, was introduced as well. So the Alliance is of outstanding importance. But you also have all these other external, these are Jewish organizations. So we're talking about ORT, we're talking about, let me just get the whole list, because if you think I remember what all these Rosh Hashanah stand for, you've got something else coming. Especially this hour when I'm really zonked. Okay, where's my page? My page with what everybody stands for. I passed it. Okay, we get OSE. That's North Africa. Otzar HaTorah. Anybody in this place knows what Otzar HaTorah is? Okay, set up by you guys right here, the Syrian community. Pardon?
I just shall.
Okay, that's very important in terms of sending things out to the Middle East. Okay, Ohale Yosef Yitzchak. Okay, that is that's Chabad. Then you have the international Jewish organizations, the World Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. Okay, this is what's set up by the American Jews, and the Jewish Agency for Palestine. I'm not talking about the introduction of Zionism. That's a separate chapter in the book. Okay? They couldn't function openly in a lot of the Middle Eastern countries. So you had the kind of organization where they would work subversively through some of the American organizations, for example. The joint would come in officially to help with this and this, but actually it was the Jewish agency and the Palestinian Jews that were coming in order to try to organize things. Now, what happens is, chronologically, as we all know, each of the different countries in the Middle East reached a point where, with the exception of just a few, where the realities of life of the late 20th century, after the creation of the State of Israel in particular, brought about a major demographic change. The major demographic change. One of the biggest ones, equal to a certain extent to what happened to the Ashkenazi Jews in Europe. Okay? Self-destruction of the communities, closing down of the communities, moving. Does everybody move to the land of Israel? Of course not. They don't move to Medina Israel. You have Jews from the Middle East just crossing the Mediterranean. They're going into France. You have them going into Italy. You have Jews coming here. Okay? You have Canada. You have Mexico. You have Latin America. You have South Africa. You have Australia. Okay, so the Jews of the Middle East end up trying to recreate community. How many Middle Eastern Jewish communities have been recreated? Not very many. Okay? Syrian Jews of Brooklyn, you guys are very unusual. All right? The Iranian Jews of the North Shore, I just gave a lecture out there, they're on their way. The Libyan Jews who I visited in Rome, and the Mashti Jews, not the Tehranis, that are living in Milan, where I'm going to be next week. You know, I have to find some backup material of the stuff that I'm working on. Okay? These are communities, the Irani community of Los Angeles, okay? Middle Eastern community in Mexico City, well, let's see, because what you really need to succeed is numbers, you need sizable numbers, okay? You need money for an infrastructure, okay? People who are going to donate funds in order to build the different kinds of buildings that you need for a community. You need leadership. Rabbinic leadership and lay leadership. Okay? If you don't have both, it's not going to succeed. Although you guys are a really wonderful example of, yes, we've had these Ashkenazi rabbis for a period of time. We just had to train our own. And goodbye, Ashkenazi rabbis. And now we've got our own community with our own rabbis coming in there. You have no idea how important you are for those of us that do this type of research. Because you're kind of proving that all of the rules and regulations do not necessarily hold true that historians try to lay down. And you need the last thing, education. Okay, so within this community structure, within the buildings, you have to educate yourselves and you have to educate your children. And if you're not going to do this, minhag in the house is not enough. It has to be on a more formal level as well. And I can, as I said, I'm writing these things on the two Middle Eastern Jewish communities living in Italy simply because it's easier, they're smaller. They know it, that if they don't set up their own schools, they're not going to succeed in passing it along. The Meshti Jews living in Milan have taken over the local yeshiva, and their teachers are their teachers. They're incredible. Yes, we go along with the Italian chief rabbi of Milan. We pretend, we go, yes, 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 and then we get our own teachers. Where do they get their teachers from? They either get them from Israel or they import them from here. Okay? So that's part of the school system. Is that a telephone? Is that like a siren of some kind? Okay, so education is one of the keys, and on that note I was going to end because, or I am going to end, because that's why I'm invited here. This is part of education. Any questions?
Just like the comment that you mentioned that the rabbis in the community here, we had Ashkenaz, and then they had their own, they left. But actually, we did have our own Sephardic rabbis from Syria.
Oh, yeah.
From Damascus.
But then you had a
high lady. They came here, and actually, the English wasn't very good. So the communication with the younger generation was difficult. So at that point, we reached out and brought the rabbis that had good English, Ashkenazic rabbis that had good English.
And Syrianized them.
Yeah.
I mean, Shulam Lieberman was my teacher many, many years ago. And then when I heard him speak Hebrew in the Bet Knesset when he was over here, I couldn't believe it was his name. I mean, he pronounced Syrian way. That's not the way he did it when I had him in Bet Midrash Lamorot.
Yeah. And Rabbi Hecht, Shimon was a Rabbish background, really, and which he still is, but he's Syrian. He Syrianized himself, actually.
Otherwise, you can't reach. They had to. Anybody else have any comments, questions?
In the communities where there was an internal autonomy, and you said how would they enforce their rulings, their decisions? Was there ever cases where they would have to go to the to government to enforce?
Sure.
And did they do
sure.
that?
If you don't have police power, and let's say it's an issue that has to do with money, they try to avoid it as much as possible. We have instances where they would go to the Muslim court system. And Islamic law is very clear in terms of how you make decisions concerning minority groups, and they're almost to a case. I can only think of one or two exceptions to it. They backed up the rabbinic decision. But what happened then is that they were able to enforce it because they could call in the police to do it. There were some really sticky points in terms of internal decisions that were made where you had, in bad periods of time, you had Masrim. You had people who, from communities, I'm just across the board, I'm talking about Ashkenazi as well as Middle Eastern Sephardic communities, where you had the danger of some people who the fear was that they were going to be given over information to dangerous governments, at the time, dangerous governments. And the Jewish communities had to make decisions that could include things like executions. Now, how do you execute, first of all, executing a fellow Jew is a whole issue unto itself, but how do you execute somebody in a community where you don't have the right to do this? The only one who has the power to execute is the Muslim power in this case. Anybody know? Because we know that there were executions of Jews by Jews. Anybody want to take a guess?
Send them to a different country? Or?
No. It would have an accident. And where would the accident take place? No, but you're close. Right next to it. The mikvah. They would be drowned. And then they would say it was an accident. We only have clues to this, hints of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I shouldn't even mention because now everybody's going to say, oh, Jews executed Jews by drowning them in the mikvah. But we know, I mean, I'm giving you an extreme example because Jewish courts tended to, on a very, very rare occasion, would they execute a fellow Jew. But they have
up until when would you say that problem? Would you say that happened up until the 18th century?
Until modernization came in, yeah. And then when you started to get the more or less secular courts, like the French brought in secular courts, the Italians had secular courts, the British had secular courts, these types of things would go into them. But, yeah, Jews weren't usually involved in capital cases.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't involved in capital cases. And certainly in connection with the Muslims, the larger Muslim society, Jews behaved themselves. You had very little to do. The Moroccans like to talk about, oh, our neighbors, we all had all these holidays. The Iranian Jews talk about we celebrated all the holidays together. Yes and no. The inviting into your house was a very, very political and formal kind of thing. And in Iran, which is Shi'i, Jews also had physical tum'ah. If they touched a cup or saucer, in the house, let's say they had these Nowruz celebrations, the New Year celebrations, I guarantee you that after their Jewish guests left the Muslim homes, these everything that they drank from or ate from was broken and destroyed because of personal tumah. Only the Shi'is have that, and in specific, the ones in Iran. You had Shi'is in Yemen as well, and it wasn't that kind of...
You say Shi'is, that's the same as Shi'ites?
Yeah, Shi'is and Shi'ites, right. It's a heterodox Muslim. Right. Anybody else?
From your analysis, the impact of the Alliance in the different communities, what do you see?
There's a whole chapter on education in the book. Yeah, Rachel Simon is a specialist on this. What do I see? Is it being positive or negative?
Right.
It's a mixed bag. There's no question in my mind that these schools put the Jews 1 to 2 generations ahead of Muslims in terms of language. If you had French, you could get a job as a clerk in a bank. You could get a job working for the French government. If you studied English, as some of the schools taught these types of English as well as one of the languages, you were at least 2 generations ahead. Okay? And in terms of 20th century history of a lot of the different countries that I was talking about, this was a major thing in terms of power and in terms of modernization. So, yes and no. I mean, how do you balance modernization with tradition? We're still dealing with it. How do you deal with Americanization and Jewish tradition? That's for us to deal with as a combination of us within our families and us within our schools, and your community make sure to marry your young people off relatively young to make sure that that happens. But there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. Because you are not forced to live in the religious communities anymore.
The negatives were that
for a number of the communities, because they looked down upon tradition, the children began to look down upon tradition too. Not that they lost respect for their rabbis, that would never happen, but as they grew into maturity, you had some of the, in a lot of the communities where the Alliance was powerful, you get a generation rivalry of the older ones and the younger ones. And the younger ones are interested in modernization. The older ones are old-fashioned. But Middle Eastern Jews are known, the children are known for having a tremendous amount of respect for the older generation and for parents and for teachers. I'm just thinking. Those 1 or 2 times I've taught in high school. Boy, am I glad I teach in college. Something happens between graduating high school and walking into your first college class. Yeah, maturity. All right, so you don't have to deal with this stuff. I could never do high school. Anybody else? I want a woman to ask a question. I can't stand it when it's only men. Come on, yes.
I was just going to ask you. This is a fight over education, but were there any strong movements against the Alliance?
Oh yes. The Aleppo rabbinate was strong enough not only to withstand it, but they did something very interesting. They introduced some of the modern studies into rabbinically controlled schools, so that you began to get French taught in some of these schools as well. Which is the we're so American that we don't understand now how much the Western language meant in terms of the possibilities for advancement or getting jobs or moving out of the lower class kind of jobs that a lot of Jews had into something that was more middle class. Okay, so you had that happening. But there were other kinds of schools as well. I just focused on the Alliance.
The Alliance co-ed?
No, they had boys' schools and they had girls' schools. Or they had the same building and they had a boys' entrance and a girls' entrance, like they used to in English school. No, here too. You know, I've passed some of the older schools. You see boys' entrance and girls' entrance over there. They were a major factor in terms of what happened to women, and I'm going to talk about that in the next lecture. So I hope everybody will come.
Would you say that the people living in Damascus were, or the Jews living in Damascus were more educated?
Not more educated, but more educated in terms of Western education. Because you had the more modern schools opening up in there. And, I mean, you know your own communities, and you know that Aleppo is the center of rabbinic power. know, and it has been and has been for millennia. Okay, Damascus moves more in the direction of modernization, in part because of the fact that Damascus was the capital of that province, yeah, and then of Syria itself.
When it a lot of our people came here to this country who were illiterate.
From
Syria, I'm not sure. From
okay.
Aleppo as well. I know for sure. Damascus, I'm not sure.
I didn't deal with
social
class.
A lot of them really lived here their entire lives.
And didn't know how to do it.
And women.
Yeah.
They got along somehow. They got numbers. They could get numbers. They knew and just signed their name immediately.
Because I didn't get into social class. Social class played a very important role in what you became. People have this wrong memory of what life was like in the old country. Everybody was not rich. Everybody did not have maids and servants and so on and so forth. Okay, you had a lot, the majority of the population was poor. And as immigration started to this country, as a result of the attempt to escape from the draft into the Ottoman Turkish army, okay, so you got more and more people moving in this direction, and then if you could get out, well, you had the anti-Jewish riots that started, or the uncomfortableness connected with what was going on in Palestine, Mandate Palestine, as it was moving towards 1948, you ended up with almost completely the poor in Syria. And you know what happened, those that remained, they were held hostage until fairly recently. We're the only country in the Middle East that happened. Okay, everybody happy? You learned something?
Very good.
Good.